the occasional interview, so that start classes Mondays at 2 p.m.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
This episode of the Kingston Live podcast is brought to you by Grand On Stage. Get the most out of the Kingston Grand Theater experience with access to pre-sale tickets, the best prices, and the best seats. Tickets for individual performances and subscriptions for the Grand On Stage season are on sale now at kingstongrand.ca.
Though some Kingston artists were born and raised in town, for many, the story of how they got here has informed their music. They bring along with them unique backgrounds and perspectives, different ways of writing and playing, and different musical influences. It's those different experiences and influences that make a scene grow and evolve. This is Kingston Live, and when our guest today moved to town, he brought a wealth of experience along with him. Whoa! It's been a long road to Kingston for singer-songwriter Frank Ryan. Born and raised in Ireland, Frank's music led him from Dublin to London and overseas to New York, Toronto, and Los Angeles. Eventually, it led him here, and it didn't take him long to get noticed. That series of adventures has left its mark on his music. Leading with graceful vocals and complex melodies, Frank combines elements of soul and blues with rock instrumentation, leading to a sound that's both intimate and virtuosic. Today we sit down with Frank to talk about his journey to Kingston, mentorship, and the impact of a scene on music. Frank Ryan, welcome to the Kingston Live podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It is so nice to have you here. Yeah. And thank you for making it here, because at the time of this recording, it's a snow day.
Yeah.
And normally we have more of the team here, and today it's just me. So it's just you and I, and we'll just make the most of this very snowy day.
No, thanks so much for having me. We got snow tires yesterday, so...
Good timing.
I'm excited. We just used them. I just want to go out and drive. Yeah.
The novelty will wear off quick.
Yeah, so I've heard. Yeah.
I thought we would start from the beginning, because you have a pretty interesting journey, as I think most people know. You come from Dublin, Ireland, and you've been to a few places before arriving to Kingston.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Dublin. My dad's from Dublin. My mom was born in Scarborough. So I'm a dual citizen, which I don't think people know that. It's funny because I meet people and they're, how are you doing with the culture shock? And I'm like, I've been here. So
how long have you been here?
I left Dublin 16 years ago or so.
Okay.
So I'm like in Kingston, like, I don't know, maybe 4 years. But I've been coming to Kingston for like 10 years.
So you had a relationship with the city already,
like,
to a certain degree.
I was born in Dublin. I grew up in Dublin, but my mom had family in Toronto and in Scarborough and stuff. So... We would come over, like every few years we would come over in the summer. So I knew, you know, I was familiar with the beaches in Scarborough and Toronto downtown and stuff. Sam the Record Man, like, you know, all those places I remember from being a kid. I have memories of kind of like Muskoka and those different places when I was small. So that I had a familiarity with Canada and with Ontario. But, you know, I grew up in Dublin. I finished school and then I moved to London, England. And I spent a couple of years in London, England.
And what were you doing there?
Music. I just went with not much of a plan, not much money, but it kind of just, everything kind of fell into place luckily, and things worked out. So I just went, I knew a couple of people, and I had a friend that kind of introduced me to a few people right off the bat. So I got there and luckily kind of was introduced to a handful of musicians, and then kind of got into gigs, got into studio sessions, and got into that whole scene. So I was there for about 2 years, and then I had some opportunities in New York, so I actually came over to Toronto, spent a summer in Toronto, and then went to New York and started working in New York, and then went back and forth.
Now, when you say opportunities, I mean, that's you say it very casually. That sounds like a big deal. It's like, I'm going to go from London to New York.
Yeah, it was kind of like, you know, it's like anything. I think you meet people just through different things that you're doing. And then I had connected with this one musician, Steve, who, you know, was like a pretty reputable drummer, producer in New York, Steve Jordan. So he had, I'd connected with him when I was young. His wife had found a band that I was in. When we were living in Dublin, she found the band on MySpace, which was, she found the band and she played it for Steve. And then I got to know Steve and then met Steve in London. He was over there playing. And he kind of invited me to New York to do some work and things like that, and kind of acted as a mentor, definitely, which was amazing and completely an invaluable experience. That was kind of my goal in going to New York, was to just kind of just play there and just check it out. And also, I think just I was just excited to go check out things. But it was funny because I remember coming to Toronto. At this point in like the early 2010s, there was quite a music scene kind of bubbling up there. So I kind of came to Toronto, you know, just like, I'll stay here and see some family and play gigs. But then I kind of got into the scene there and got playing gigs there, and then went to New York. And I was lucky enough to kind of work with Steve, record with Steve, but also just he brought me around to sessions. He brought me all around New York, introduced me to tons of people.
I don't think we talk about that enough or hear about that enough in the podcast. And I think we don't think enough about the value of mentorship, because it sounds like that was a definitely really great experience.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, definitely. And I think his point to me was that he had had that as he was coming up. And I think it was important for him to
pass it along.
Yeah. And he did that for a handful of musicians. You go to the studio with a guy like that, who he's now the drummer in the Rolling Stones. He took over for Charlie Watts, which is wild, you know. And just to be in proximity of that kind of expertise and that kind of
experience.
Yeah. And, you know, the guy's played with everyone from like James Brown to, you know, he was the Letterman drummer. He was in the Blues Brothers. It kind of goes on and on. So you would just sit and kind of ask him something, and it would be like, wow, really? And even still, I think there's still things that he's told me that years later, I'm kind of like, you know. So to have had that opportunity was amazing. So I spent a few years kind of playing around New York, and then I would kind of go back and forth to Toronto. It was different at that time in Toronto.
How so? I can kind of guess.
Yeah.
From what I've heard.
I mean, I love Toronto, and don't get me wrong, like, it's great and it's still great, but it's different now because I think just a lot of those places have gone. Rent is nuts.
It's funny, one of the conversations that keeps coming up is the gentrification of Toronto. And so my brother Peter, who's involved in the podcast, his wife is from Toronto. So the two of them spent a lot of time in Toronto. And something that keeps coming up is the fact that there's not as much room for artists now, like any kind of artist, because they're getting priced out of the market and out of the community.
Yeah.
And Anita from Roswell Rehearsals was here a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And we were talking about Toronto and how there's a lack of rehearsal spaces because these spaces are getting bought and made into condos or repurposed in some way.
Yeah, there was the Rehearsal Factory. There was one on Richmond, downtown, like Richmond and Bathurst, and there was one on Geary. Those disappearing, and then Honest Ed's was kind of like a symbolic thing.
Well,
you know,
that's
once that
the
was
thing
gone.
We were talking about.
Yeah.
We were comparing Kingston to Toronto because we were talking about the S&R building, and you mentioned you've spent some time here, so you probably remember the store S&R.
Yeah.
The store closed, but the building is being used for many different things, whereas in Toronto, something like Honest Ed's just gets bulldozed and made into condos.
Yeah, it's a shame. People don't really stop to consider, you know, I really want to live in this place because of the culture and because
character
of
and
character
accessibility
and all these great bars, and I can go see jazz and I can go do this and that. you bring all these things in, and then all that disappears because the people you want to go see playing in bars can't afford to live there, or, you know, the people running these like great bars or great clubs or whatever can't afford to keep running them because the rent is outrageous, and then everything just kind of becomes like a Wendy's or like a chain or
Starbucks in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's been a shame. I mean, like, there was the Hideout in Toronto. It was like a great music club. That was a great spot. That's a Wendy's now.
Like, actually a Wendy's?
It's actually a Wendy's.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is just crazy. One thing that I love about Kingston is that it changes and evolves too, but there's a real kind of focus on maintaining a healthy music scene. I really feel here like people take it seriously.
Well, and that's interesting because I hadn't really made that connection. I mean, we've talked on the podcast about the scene itself, but often in isolation, because getting back to what we're saying about Toronto,
yeah,
I've over the years I've kind of picked on Kingston just a little bit for having a slightly overinflated sense of historical significance.
Right.
Like, when you go to Fort Henry, it's an amazing place, and
yeah,
I love Fort Henry, but there's a plaque when you walk in that basically says nothing happened here.
Right.
There was no battle, no shots fired in anger, I think is the phrase they used. So growing up here, for me, there was a desire to sort of resist that to a certain degree, but as I get older, I'm now seeing the benefits of holding on to some of the past while looking toward the future.
Yeah, that's funny, too, coming from Ireland, because, like, in Dublin, you know, you'd be walking home from the bar and there's, like, three guys taking a pee on a 7,000-year-old castle on the way home from the bar. And people are like, look at this house, it's, like, 200 years old. And it's like, great, you know. But coming from Ireland, it's an interesting perspective to have when you're kind of in North America, because it's kind of, you know, it's a melting pot of different cultures, which I love. Canada's really kind of just one place for everyone. I don't know if everyone always feels that way, and it's definitely not perfect.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that's the goal, certainly.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people would have different opinions on how much that goal has been achieved. But no, I think that's the right way to go about it.
Yeah.
Certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting. I mean, I think the big draw for me and for, like, friends that are from Europe that we talk about is just the nature and the access to just such intense raw nature, which, you know, you have in Ireland definitely too. But I think it's the fact that, like, everything that lies north of here, there's obviously Ottawa and Sudbury and many places north of Kingston, but it's just, I think, the presence of this huge area north of here. There's a feeling that comes with that, I think.
Well, there's that joke or meme about how you can drive 12 hours in Europe and be in 3, 4, 5 different countries. You can drive 12 hours in Ontario and still be in Ontario.
Yeah. It's funny. I definitely agree, and I think it's a hard country for musicians to tour.
Yes, that's, you know, the other side of
how
it.
How do you drive from Toronto to Winnipeg? And people do it, and then play a show the same night.
Yeah.
And then drive from there to, like, Vancouver. It's crazy. Kingston's got a unique placement in the sense that you can get to Montreal, you can get to Ottawa, you can get to Toronto in a span of like 2 hours without traffic.
Or with traffic, but it doesn't take you 3 days to get there.
Yeah, and I think that's really beneficial to musicians, because you can play in Hamilton, you can play in Quebec, you can play in Ottawa, and even if you want to make the jump to the States, there's Syracuse, Ithaca, Rochester, New York City, all that's accessible, Boston, you know, Vermont. So it does have a unique kind of geographical kind of opportunity. Whereas I think if you're living in the other parts of Canada, you don't necessarily have that. For me, it was definitely like, I started coming to Kingston because I met my wife, and she had grown up here for a bit. She'd lived in a few different places, and then she came back here and she went to Queens. And we would come here at Christmas and in the summer for like a couple of weeks each time. So we were living in the States at the time. We met in New York, and then we moved out to Los Angeles. We were living there for like 6 years. Anytime we came back here, I was always really taken aback by how much music there was, like, everywhere. Which, there's obviously a lot of music in New York and there's a lot of music in LA, but it's the same thing. It's spread out. I mean, LA, like, if you want to go get a bottle of water, you have to drive for like an hour. So, you know what I mean? It's just, you just live in your car and it's a great place and everything. And I suppose, like, the good thing about it is you can go, one night I went to see James Gadson, who plays drums on like all those Bill Withers tunes, you know, like Ain't No Sunshine, Use Me. That's James. Yeah. He's playing like a strip mall. And he had like Mike Finnegan on keys, who plays on Electric Ladyland. He plays on like Rainy Day, Dream Away with Jimi Hendrix. You go see like guys like that in a strip mall. You know what I mean? Like a Thai restaurant in a strip mall. So that kind of thing is great. I think when I came to Kingston with my wife, initially I was kind of like, oh, this reminds me of Dublin when I was growing up, because it was just a kind of smaller area. You know, it was a unique time to grow up there because there was a thing called the Celtic Tiger, which was this like influx of money into the economy. We'd gone from a third world country in like the 80s to this like extremely wealthy country in like no time. So there was a lot of, you know, just like a lot of stuff popping up, and it was a kind of happy, fun time there. And there was a lot of great artists that were coming out of, you know, the like U2, the Cranberries, everything in the 90s, and even Jeff Buckley too, which was kind of not, he's not Irish, but he was really big in Ireland, so it's like he almost thought he was Irish. There was a really, really kind of abundant music scene there when we were growing up. We were like 15 and you could go see, in one night, you could like sneak into bars, fairly like loose. Music would start at like 2 p.m. You could see a blues band, then you could see a reggae band, then a ska band, then a soul band, an originals band. So there's just tons of music bars, tons of clubs and stuff. So coming to Kingston, I really kind of felt like, wow, this is the closest thing I've seen to that thing that we had growing up, where it's just a small area, but there's just tons of bands and they're good. You know, it's not like tons of bands and like they're all right. It's like tons of, you go see people and you're like, wow, like this is really, really good. Like there's a high quality.
Yeah, one of the comments that stuck in my mind that somebody made a few years ago was Kingston bands are not bar bands. There's a lot of people doing really interesting things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of jazz here too, which I don't think gets talked about enough. Like there's really, really good jazz.
Yes, and you know what? I think I'm going to take some of the responsibility for that, because we've talked about with the podcast, the team, we talk about all these different things we want to cover, and we've talked about jazz, but we've never really gotten into it. So that may have to happen.
Yeah, that surprised me too. I mean, there's like amazing jazz, amazing players that will just, you know, blow your mind.
Well, speaking of amazing players, I want to talk about your music.
Thanks.
And where do I start? Your influences, first of all, I know on your website and on some of your media sites, you know, the Beatles and Bob Dylan and Aretha Franklin, Stevie Wonder, and I can hear all of that. I'm curious, just to start, is there a musician or an album or a song that sort of pushed you over that cliff of, I want to be a musician, this is my thing?
Yeah, I grew up with the Beatles. Like, I think my earliest memories are playing Beatles tapes. I would say like a lot of the Beatles stuff, early Beatles stuff. And then when I was a teen, I was just around a lot of different musicians. I think when I started like high school, there was all these guys that used to take my school bus and they would sit down in the back of the bus with their guitars, like their electric guitars, and just kind of show each other like licks. So I would start sitting with them and kind of watch what they would do. And I think, again, just the benefit of being in a kind of fertile music scene is that you're just around other players and you can kind of like, how did you do that? Like, show me how you do that little thing. What's that little thing you do? And then, so there was a lot of that, but I would say I got introduced to Jimi Hendrix when I was starting high school. I was around a lot of music growing up, but I hadn't really been exposed to that. And I had just started playing guitar and I loved the Beatles and I loved blues in general, but I think hearing Jimi Hendrix, I was like, wow, like that just blew my mind, you know?
Yeah.
And then sort of seeing the videos of stuff he could do, it was like insane. So I would say that, I don't know if there's one particular song, but I would say that was a kind of point where I had just started playing guitar at the same time where I was introduced to that.
How young were you when you started playing guitar?
I think I started when I was 11.
Okay.
11, yeah.
I'm going to be honest with you. I've been And I'm not going to ask you to tell me how old you are, but there's that thing in the back of your mind.
I'm a ripe 56.
Yeah. But it's neat because you seem young, but you talk about all this experience.
Yeah.
And you mentioned MySpace.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
yeah.
takes me back.
56, I'm telling you. No. Yeah.
But yeah, we don't have to get into that. But I first became aware of you and your music probably a year ago, I would say. And I remember that because I got very excited. I was like, wow, this guy's really talented. And it's coming
so
from a very deep place. Like your guitar skills and your vocal skills are very advanced, but you make it seem effortless at the same time. It just seems to flow. And there's a few things that a few different avenues we could take there. I do want to talk about singing and mm-hmm. vocals.
Yeah.
Like, where does that fit in? Like, which one comes first for you?
It's been a bit of an odyssey. I think when I started, like I say, I was introduced to Jimi Hendrix. I really liked the Chili Peppers when I was around that age too. I liked John Frusciante as a guitar player. So you get that, and then you get introduced to Jimi Hendrix, and it's like, oh, then I see where that's come from. And then through that, all this other stuff opens up, like Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf. Mm-hmm. So I was really just obsessed with the guitar when I was that age. And like when I was playing, like the first kind of band setup that I was playing in as a teenager, I was kind of like, I was doing the singing because it was kind of just, we didn't really have a singer. And like they were kind of trying to kick me out because they were like, you can't sing. So, you know, and I really had a hard time when I first started singing because I was just shy. And I used to sing like sideways on the mic. I didn't want to face...
You didn't want to expose yourself?
Yeah, I don't know. I just felt like
There's a vulnerability to singing.
Definitely,
for sure.
Yeah. And the other thing too in Dublin is like, and just Ireland in general, like everybody sings. Here you go to a party, people are like, oh, sing a couple of songs, and like, it'll be me and maybe there'll be one other person at the party, hopefully, that can sing. But like there, everybody's... It's not like a case of like, you sing, you don't. Everybody sings. Everybody has like a song that they do. And it's not really like you go to bat. It's just everybody sings. And sometimes if you're too showy, people, oh, you know, look at you and your fancy notes. You know what I mean? So it's not. And that's kind of like with everything. That's with guitar playing. That's just with life in general. You know what I mean? It's like, it's a good place. It's a good way to keep people in check. You know.
And that's very interesting because historically, and when I talk about historically, I mean just the human race, singing was something that everybody did, and it was a means of building community and connection. And it's only been in the last few hundred years, and mostly a Western thing, where music, it's like, oh, you have to be skilled to do music. You have to have a certain qualification. But
yeah,
I would like to see us get back to that, you know, the way you're describing Dublin, where everybody sings.
Yeah, I definitely think being Irish and being from that tradition, you know, my granddad used to just sit in the pub, and at the end of the night, he would sit and sing a couple of songs. Someone else would, you know, it was like you take turns, and they just sing a cappella, 18-verse songs. And you'd be like... You go to take a sip, and you know, like the next verse comes, you know, so that's again a storytelling tradition that has a lot in common with what you would find in like the indigenous cultures here and different things. It was a way of telling stories of like, here's the struggles we went through, or here's what we went through, and it was a way of passing down stories. So I think for me, definitely back there, it's much more just part of the fabric of the place.
Part of the culture.
But definitely with singing, like it was gradual for me for a long time. And then I think there was just, I felt like a flip at some point in my early 20s, something changed.
I noticed that, and I'm very surprised to hear you say that, because I hear your vocals and my thought is he seems like a singer first. And a lot of guys, I'm going to say guys in particular, they get into rock music, they start playing guitar, they start playing drums because they're excited about the music. And you find yourself in a room with your bandmates and everybody's looking at each other. Somebody's got to sing, right? Singing becomes this kind of necessary evil.
Yeah.
And anytime I meet a vocal teacher or a vocal coach, I'll always ask them, how many of your students are male? And it's usually none.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So what happened with me was, I think it was honestly just from singing like 10, you know, you talk about like 10,000 hours and that concept, which I completely agree is true. I kind of feel like it's been 100,000 hours for me.
It sounds like it. That's why I can't figure out how old you are.
Yeah, it feels like it too. 56. But it's funny too. I think just from singing for 4 hours in clubs, night after night after night after night after night, you just get stronger. I think one thing that I started doing when I was in my teens too, I started playing in bands, so I think there's a lot to hide behind. There's a lot to hide behind, like, you can just noise, basically, and guitar solos. It was like the most of the songs were just a guitar solo with, like, a couple of lyrics thrown around it, you know. But I started busking on the street in Dublin. I started when I was about 16 and then did that until I was, like, left when I was, like, 19. That really helped just projection because I didn't have a microphone. So you're just trying to get across. And there's a couple of people, same things, just singers in Dublin. I was like, how do you, you know, and they were just kind of like, just some people, like little tips, like really how you stand, like your posture, really thing, like just someone's pulling the string up, kind of, you know, do that. Just picture far away and like you're trying to get to that. Don't push. Little things, just, you get these like old blues player guys at gigs and they'd be, oh, you know, let me tell you how to sing, you know. Cigarettes are actually really good for your voice. You know, stuff like that. But so I would definitely say busking helped, and that gave me a lot of strength and then tone. And then I just think from playing a lot of gigs for years, and then I think around the time of my early 20s, I kind of hit a point where I just think I'd sang so much, I kind of feel like I had some sort of breakthrough with it, which is like anything. It's like any instrument or anything you do, not just in music, you know, it's like, whatever, if you're doing something, you kind of do something, you kind of break past where you're like, and I've had a few different points like that with music in general, not just kind of singing, but like, I've kind of, you know, I'm trying to figure something out and then there's some sort of breakthrough. And then, so I definitely feel like I had that, and then I had that for a couple of years, but then I blew my voice out.
How'd you do that?
I just had a gig, just at a club gig.
You just push it too far?
Loud drummer. And I was kind of sick. And I just pushed too hard. Didn't really know what I was doing. And all of a sudden I couldn't like talk for a few days. Then I had a gig. Then I went to the gig. Then I couldn't even like talk, let alone sing. Everything was like, you know, Leonard Cohen. Kind of like, you know, I dropped all the keys. And it was like, you know, hello.
Pretty low key kind of.
Yeah. Like those, like, you know, those last Leonard Cohen albums, you know what I mean? But I had a friend in Toronto, guitar player, Dave Kirby. He's a touring guitar player and he sings backup. And he had some issues with his voice, just singing backup on tours. And he said to me, oh, there's a woman I found in Oakville and her name is Judith Lander, who is a renowned jazz singer and great artist like in her own right. And he was like, you know, he just suggested I go just do one session with her. And I went, that was a game changer, I think, to go with Judith, because she just laughed. Like I went and I sang for her and she just kind of was, oh, okay, here's what you're doing. Like, it's all just breathing. She's just, here's how you breathe, here's how you. And I've gone really kind of down the deep end of like trying to figure out what did this singer do, and anytime I meet other singers too, I'm always kind of like, what do you do to warm up, like Savannah, right? Yeah. Like I'm
wonderful,
like,
voice.
Yeah, and I'm like, what are you doing in particular? So I'm really fascinated by like any singer I meet. Really, I'm kind of like, what do you do? You know, some singers have a whole warm up. They'll have a whole kind of like system.
Exercises.
Yeah. And then other singers are like, yeah, I have a shot of tequila and like a joint. And I'm like, I get up and sing. You know, it's like, so it's there's not really a set thing, but I'm so eternally grateful to Judith because she just became a friend and she's an amazing singer, but just an amazing person and is hilarious. And I would just go see her from time to time. And I literally think about her every day because I'm... wake up and there's just little things, and like, and even just not singing, just how you speak and like your breath, just when you're breathing, and it's like, I'm breathing wrong, So that was a huge changing point. And I think from then on, I was able to apply that. I was able to go sing in a club for 4 hours and my voice wouldn't hurt. And I could go sing for, I could do two club shows in the same day and I could still talk after it. So, which hadn't been the case before.
So what do you do to warm up?
Shot tequila. No, joking. I basically try and just sit at home and then I go through different, like, just breath things. I think yoga and anything yoga esque definitely helps because it's so breathing focused. My wife opened a yoga studio downtown, Surf Shack Yoga, shameless plug. If you can do yoga before you sing the day of, I find that's really good to kind of just open you up. I go through just a few different things, a few different breath, like placement things that she showed me, and then I have kind of different songs that I'll play around with just on an acoustic, and I'll try and sing softly and then kind of build up. I don't always stick to it. Sometimes, like, life's busy and I get to a gig and I'm like in the bathroom before the gig going like you know, doing stuff, and I was like, someone, you know, looking over at me like, what's this guy doing? So just things like that, you know. I think the more you warm up the better, but also I think if you sing on a regular basis it helps.
And I think you inadvertently solved the mystery for me of why there are no male singing students. And when you talk about your story, my mind goes to, maybe it's the same reason that we're not going to therapy, you know. We're just not asking for help.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't, I mean, I would recommend Judas if anyone wants to drive to Oakville.
Well, it sounds like it was a great experience.
Totally recommend it. Yeah, it was kind of like having a car and you're driving with the parking brake on. And you're kind of like, why was the car skidding? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then it's like, wait. And then it's like, oh, you know. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's it, you know. Yeah, it's like anything, though. It's still, I think it will always be, you know, an odyssey. Because I'm still kind of figuring out different things. Or there's new places that open up. And I'm like, oh, I haven't gone into that area before. Mm-hmm. It's like with guitar, too, or like with writing. It's kind of like, what if I try this? So I love that about it, because it's kind of, it's always a new discovery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear some of those vocals. Let's drop a track.
Okay.
And what are we going to hear?
This is called Stone Me, and it's the latest release of, I've basically been recording an album for the last couple of years, and it's been a gradual process, because I started during the global mess that was
the pandemic. Yes.
So, you know, I started during the tail end of the pandemic. So I've been making the album for the last couple of years, and it's basically just finished. I just finished it like a week ago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I've been releasing singles from the album over the last while. Stomy's the latest single I released. I'll probably release one more single and then put the whole thing out. And then it'll be available on vinyl. And, yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah, Stormy's the latest song that came out, and it's gotten a lot of love, and people have been super nice about it, so that's always great. I'm always happy to hear people like it.
blues that just wants your spirits to cry.
This episode of Kingston Live is brought to you by Grand Onstage. Grand Onstage takes you beyond the regular Kingston Grand Theater experience. It's a subscription option that gives you access to pre-sale tickets, the best prices, and the best seats. That means you can customize your own individual package starting at just 4 performances. Want to bring friends? Subscriber pricing applies to their tickets too. And if your plans change, just exchange your tickets for another performance. Tickets for individual performances and subscriptions for the Grand Onstage season are on sale now at kingstongrand.ca.
I want to talk a little more about your music. We've established, you have a lot of experience. You've been all over the world. You're apparently 56 years old.
Yeah.
Why was this the right time to release an album?
I had been in the States, and I had been working in New York with Steve, as I was saying, and one thing he had said to me, I remember the first time I went out to LA, we were talking about how much New York had changed, how kind of corporate and financy it had gotten compared to when he was growing up. And one thing he had said was, if you could find a place that was kind of in close proximity to a major music hub or like major place, but it was a kind of small scene and it was just kind of a little bit cheaper to live and there was a lot of art and music, he's like, that would almost be better because, you know, when you live in like a big city, your main focus is just trying to afford to live there these days.
Yeah.
And you don't have a lot of spare time to create. That was one of the things. I was living in cities and I was busy because I was just kind of hustling and you're trying to make things happen. I was in LA. And then I'd met my wife in New York. We were in LA, but we were just both, you know, busy, you know, just working. I was doing like sessions and gigs and different things. But all the while I was writing, I'd always been writing and I'd always written and I put out a couple of EPs and, you know, they'd like done moderately well. I played like some festivals and different things in the scale of like an independent artist. So I was kind of talking to different people about making an album, and there was a few different options of kind of like working with a label that would fund making an album. So I was kind of like writing in my head. I was trying to write like the best album I could write and then kind of be like, okay, you know, and then that would be like the album I make. But I kind of realized it's very seldom that you work with like a label or you work with an external music company where they don't want to kind of come in and have their own kind of agenda or their own say with things, which is just, you know, the deeper you get into the music industry, the less it has to do with music. It's just all money. And so it's kind of like you go in, you're like, hey, I have this idea to have this like backwards guitar solo with like 18 backwards guitars at the end of the song. I'm just like, that's never going to get on radio. It did get on radio. So
congratulations.
But, yeah, thanks. But I think it was, I had wanted to make an album for a long time and I had like, as I was saying with Steve, kind of as a mentor role, he was kind of like, just keep writing, keep writing. I spent a lot of time, maybe too much time, but I spent a lot of time just really trying to write, like writing tons of different things over the years, especially when we were living in California. And then it was kind of, I was getting around, I would say pre-pandemic, I was starting to kind of put together like pre-production for what would be an album. And I was kind of shopping that around, and there were some options to go different routes with making an album. And the more I kind of looked at these routes, it was kind of like, that's not going to, the end result won't match what I hear in my head.
Yeah.
And I think that can be hard, because I think there's a level of compromise that a lot of musical artists are pushed into in the industry, where sometimes you're just trying to like pay the rent, and sometimes you're just trying to get by, and someone offers you something and it's like, great, because it can change your life. But that's also a double-edged sword, because then
you're playing by their rules.
Yeah. And sometimes maybe they know what they're talking about, but other times, you know, you're dealing with people that aren't musicians, that aren't artists, and they just kind of look at like trend projections. It's kind of like, well, you know, TikTok says this is what's going to be big in 6 months. Mm-hmm. And you're like, great, but like, is that what Pink Floyd did when they did Dark Side of the Moon or something? You know, that was always my thing. It was like, they were like, well, you're not Pink Floyd. And I was like, I know, I understand that, but like, great art is just art. And it's like, well, that is an unpopular opinion, I think.
Well, I think any artist is going to understand that good art is a reaction not to an industry, but to the universe around
you. Absolutely. I think, especially being in LA at that time, I love LA, and I had a great time living there. But there was also this, it's kind of like the hub for all that kind of influencer celebrity thing. There's also like, you know, these great gigs you can go, you can see these amazing musicians, and there's also like the really funky kind of artsy side of it. But there's also that kind of,
there's also Hollywood.
Yeah. And yeah. So, you know, people are kind of like, well, you know, to focus less on your songs and more on your TikTok, you know. It's like,
That's one of the most common complaints we've had on this podcast is artists. And I'm very grateful that it sounds like with this album, you were able to do it on your own terms, and it sounds like it came together very naturally.
Yeah, well, I think I'm giving you a long-winded explanation, but I think that was where I was at, where I was kind of in a situation where it was becoming clear that what I wanted it to be, or what I wanted for myself in terms of what I was doing, wasn't going to be achievable unless I just kind of did it myself. So it was just a case of timing with the pandemic. And I had like some stuff going on that was kind of coming to fruition that I wasn't sure about. And then the pandemic basically just shut everything down. Mm-hmm. And then it was terrible for everyone. And it was just so bizarre. It's still bizarre. I think everybody's still trying to make sense of all of it. But it did afford me some time that I hadn't given myself, maybe, to just be at home. So I think my wife and I made the decision to come back up to Canada, because we just kind of, I think that's self-explanatory.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
we were living.
I'm getting the vibe. Yeah,
yeah, we were living down there. We had a great time living there, but we felt like it was changing, and it's changed what it was to what it is now.
Yeah.
So we came back, and I had always felt like over the years, I loved Kingston, and I was like, every time we come visit Kingston, I'd have a great time. I'd be surrounded by music, and I was always kind of like, I could live there in a heartbeat, because it's just a great place. And you start thinking about having a family and different things like this, and you kind of go like, where would the ideal place be to do that? Mm-hmm. And so Kingston just kind of naturally, she had connections here. And then we had met, you know, I became friends with Maddie, who owns the Toucan, runs the Toucan, and 8 years ago, just from a visit, and we just got to know Maddie. So when we came back, we already knew a few people, and I was able to kind of come in, start playing gigs as things were opening back up. And that was kind of the opportunity to actually make an album, where I had a bit more time, and all of a sudden we were in this kind of much more relaxed environment that was very conducive to music. I don't think I could have made it if we had stayed where we were, or if we hadn't been in that situation. So coming to Kingston really kind of was a catalyst for all these other good things that happened. But the album was kind of a really big part of that. That was really refreshing to just be able to just kind of walk around and see things and, you know, or walk down the street and hear someone ripping guitar in their house.
Yeah.
Or hear some band rehearsing. I used to hear Oak Ridge Avenue rehearsing like across the street, you know, and I'd sit and like have a coffee and listen to them playing. And it was, it's just great. And I think just being able to be in a place where it's not just music, it's art. There's tons of artists. There's artisan craft makers and different things. There's a lot of independent businesses. But there's a real support for people here that I think you lack in other places. And it's community, right? It's just, you realize the importance of it and you realize the strength of it.
Yeah, well, and to speak as an independent business person, I talk to a lot of other business people, and I meet so many people that either left Kingston and came back, or they came here and they don't want to leave.
Yeah.
And the thing that we keep coming back to is Kingston's a very accessible place. It's big enough that there's, like you described, big enough that there's a lot of things going on, but it's small enough that it's still accessible.
Yeah.
You know, you can get into those communities, and it doesn't take an hour to get anywhere.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, which kind of brings you back to the point. It was just like, it's an easy place to live. You know, the rent's getting more expensive, which is...
That did come to mind. That is a bit of a challenge.
That's the biggest, issue, I think, in terms of trying to keep a music community. But I think it's just, I don't know what it is. There's just a combination. It's the right combination of things. It's the right size. It's the right geography. It's the right kind of just mix of things, you know. Mm. And there's just a real, like, love and support for things. And there's so many other places where, you know, if there's like a music venue that's threatened or something, like people, like a really good example is Brian's record option.
I was just
when he had that flood and then everybody came and...
It was a very It's a Wonderful Life kind of moment.
Yeah, definitely. But I think, you know, you're in a place and you see those things, you know, coming from like city life in the States to being around that, it's a real dose of soul. And it's been great, you know?
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
What are you most excited about for the future?
Everything, really. Family. We have my son. That's just magic. But everything, really. There's just so much to be excited about. I think, you know, it's funny, right? Like, the world is kind of in a very dark, negative place.
Globally, there's a lot of darkness.
Yeah, I know. I try to just kind of shut that out because what's in front of me is just magic. And I think if you can just focus on the good things and focus on what you're grateful for. And I'm really, really grateful for many things. So I'm just excited for everything. I'm excited to be here because I think there's a lot of exciting things happening. It kind of feels to me like a bit like Woodstock, you know what I mean? Like the way people would talk about Woodstock, like I read this book called Small Town Talk. It's a great book if anyone's like interested in it.
I like books. I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Small Town Talk, which is about all these artists that were sick in New York and went to Woodstock and then set up camp and kind of why it kind of reminds me of that. I kind of feel that, you know, I meet more and more people who are moving here, musicians and things, and I think it's exciting because everybody's bringing something to the table, and it's great. It's been amazing for me to move here and just have so many doors open and people be so warm and welcoming. So I'm just excited to be around the fertile kind of music scene too, because you feed off it. You know, if you're living in the middle of nowhere and there's no music around you and you're a musician, it's okay. And you can listen to records and you can kind of...
But it's hard to create in a vacuum.
Yeah, and there's different things that inspire you that you never would have thought of. But if you're just kind of exposed to it, you go out to it and all of a sudden you see... I mean, like, I remember being at the Toucan once and, like, the China Cat Riders, the Grateful Dead band, Dan Kurtz and those guys were playing. And, you know, they were playing some sort of, like, dual guitar line. I was like, what is that? You know what I mean? It's just, it's different things that I wouldn't sit and like open up some Grateful Dead album and listen to that, but then all of a sudden I'm exposed to that because I'm just here, you know? So I think I'm just excited to experience all that, you know, because it does benefit you I think, like, massively as an artist, to be around other artists. There's also this thing, Brian Eno has a thing he calls senius, where he's like, there's no such thing as a genius, there's senius. It's like, you're just a product of an environment, of people. And I think that's really true, because there's so many different... Musicians always kind of tend to come out of, like, scenes, you know what I mean? There's exceptions, definitely, but they tend to be bred of, like, a particular kind of group. That's what I think, anyway. I could be completely wrong. But
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I mean, history would back you up. There's been all kinds of scenes over the decades.
Yeah, well, like you were saying, like Woodstock or like California and like the
60s. I always think of, like, you know, the Seattle grunge scene or the L.A. glam scene and, you know, punk in New York.
Yeah, I think the Seattle grunge scene is actually probably one of the more applicable kind of comparisons to Kingston, too, because... It's a lot of different bands and different people kind of, it's like musically promiscuous, you know what I mean? Like people, it's kind of like one guy will play with one band, then they'll play with another band, and then people swap members and different things.
And very DIY at the same time.
That's the biggest thing too. And I think kind of coming back to like my whole approach with the album was, I just kind of realized like, I'm just going to, if I actually want to make something that I want to listen to, you have to do it yourself. And I think... There's a real, not just with Kingston, but I think like across the board in Canada and the Canadian music scene, there seems to be this growing DIY scene, you know?
Yeah.
And it's great. Because Spotify, you know, blatantly stealing money from people. I think there's this misconception that there's no money in the music industry anymore, and there's just as much money as there ever has been. It's all ad revenue. Mm-hmm. The artists are making money. It's just... Spotify aren't giving it to the artists, which is kind of just wild. And I don't think it'll go on forever, but unfortunately we're kind of in the time where this is happening. So from what I can tell and what I can see, and different artists are talking, and people are kind of like, what's an alternative we can do? And it's very much the same as a kind of shop local. You talk about like being like anti-Starbucks. It's like, don't buy Starbucks anymore. You know, go to your local coffee shop.
Close your Amazon account.
Yeah. You know, go just shop local. And I think...
And you can do that here. That's the great thing. Yeah. You go downtown, there's so many amazing businesses.
That's the thing. And I think, you know, is it great that you can open up the entire Beatles catalog at the drop of a hat and play it? Yeah, it's amazing. But it's more so kind of like, you know, there's amazing music here. There's some amazing, amazing artists. There's amazing bands. Some of whom I would be as happy listening to as like the Beatles or Joni Mitchell. You know, they'd be part of that rotation. It's not kind of like there's...
Yeah, well, and that's something I've noticed about my own listening habits is people talk about, oh, support local artists. I've never liked that phrase because it sounds like you're asking for a handout. Mm-hmm. But there's so much talent here. You don't really need that attitude. Like there are people I listen to just because I like them. Like on my turntable, I have a stack of vinyl on my coffee table right now. It's probably half local.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. There is a real vinyl sort of appetite here too. You know, great record stores. You've Brian's record option, Zap Records, Something Else Records.
Now and Then in the mall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think to have that resource, the idea being if people can just kind of shop local and like buy records, kind of go back to, not go back to the way we were necessarily, but just kind of like reject things that are just not ethical.
Adopt models that actually work.
Yeah.
And that are sustainable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think...
I don't care if we go forwards or backwards. Yeah. I just want...
But it's like you're saying, Amazon, it's across the board, right? It's not just music. It's so many things. Mm-hmm. And we need a kind of major shift in just kind of moving away from things that exploit people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing with Spotify. It's unfortunately, like, art is always going to be present. There's never going to be a time when it's not art. Like, artists, it's a compulsion. It's like, if you're an artist, you're just going to, it's going to come out of you somehow.
You have to do it.
Yeah. And so from what I've seen and what I can gather, I think there's kind of some movements, especially in Canada, to just kind of like go to local shows, go to your local record store, like buy albums, stop using Spotify, because it doesn't really serve anyone any good other than the people that make money off of it. Yeah. So I do feel that, and I feel that from shows. People buy merch. People, once the album's finished, well, it's finished now, but like I'm going to get some vinyl press, because people are constantly like can I buy like vinyl? You know, I don't want to listen to Spotify. I'd like to buy your vinyl. I'm like, that would be way better.
Sounds better. It helps the artist. It's,
yeah, so I'm pretty hopeful about that entire kind of shift. It's almost like, you know, like the dead end internet theory where it's all just bots. The internet is 80% bots now, apparently.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, will it just get to the point, I think, where it's like, what's the point in even engaging with it? It's like people crave
connection.
Connection and just human experience.
Yeah.
And I definitely felt that after the pandemic, at shows, people were hungry for live music. They wanted to come to shows. They were emotional when they would go to shows because it was something we didn't know if we get to do again. So I think there's a lot to be hopeful for in that sense. And I do think, although it is huge, it's an enormous country and it's huge and it's really hard to get across or get around, there still is a real kind of great touring scene and a lot of artists kind of, there's just a kind of camaraderie with a lot of artists and, you know, there's a support system.
Well, I think it's out of necessity because it's like any other community, even if you want to look back at the, you know, like 10,000 years, the very sort of early stages of human civilization, community was a means of survival, right? And I think in places like here in Kingston, and maybe I'd like to see this within the music industry as a whole, bringing back that sense of community and supporting each other and making it sustainable in that way.
Yeah, it's funny. I had a conversation with a this family member was saying, you know, we're talking about what if the internet was disconnected for a day? What would happen? She was just like, oh, chaos. Be riots, there'd be looting, there'd be people would just go crazy, everything would stop working. And I'm like, but you're in downtown Toronto. I'm like, in Kingston, I feel like everybody would just like go to Skeleton Park and bring out a couple of guitars. And I think that's, for me, that's the difference of, it doesn't really matter what happens here, people have each other's backs. And that's a lost art, I think.
Yes.
With just, you know, life in general. And I think that's, again, just not just with music, but just, you know, living somewhere and having a family or anything, you know, to have that around is, it's magic, really, because it's rare. It's becoming more and more rare. So,
yeah. Frank Ryan, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I think we'll have to talk again at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Frank Ryan, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I think we'll have to talk again at some point.
Yeah, absolutely.
This has been Kingston Live. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share it, tell a friend, or subscribe on your platform of choice. For show listings, artist info, and all things Kingston music, check out kingstonlive.ca. Kingston Live was produced in Kingston by Soundwise. Hosted by John Sanfilippo. Writing and research by Peter Sanfilippo. Executive producer Rob Howard. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at podcast@kingstonlive.ca.